And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Patty Quatro, we have spent the last three episodes talking in depth about this incredible press that you received after the release of your single on Hideout Records in 1966. That was Valentine's Day. I loved reading from it. It really was a snapshot of the band, but also, strangely, like this crystal ball for all of you, or for us, because we got to see where you were going in the future. We talked about upcoming gigs, but you also did play gigs with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and your former boyfriend, Mitch Ryder, of the Detroit Wheels, and so many others. And yes, Listeners, Patty is blushing again. But the press article also talked about, and this is what I want to focus on today with you, how you were becoming a hot band and very much in demand. You were playing gigs, you were recording, you were doing TV shows as dancers. So I want to hear, first of all, more about being in demand, because the other things I want to pick up on is how much was going on while lineup changes continue. So tell us how you were in demand, some stories, backstage memories, fans approaching you, anything you can touch upon.
At that moment in time, society still considered a girl band quite a novelty, and that seemed to escalate the interest in booking the pleasure seekers. We were still doing the college circuit, teen clubs, autoramas, state fairs, everything that we could do, but also going out of town for gigs. There wasn't yet any overt type of fans like approaching us in a negative way. That was what was really surprising. By this time, it was like already accepted that we could play by the audience, by the girls. They were loving it because we were doing something so unusual for women. We didn't hear any negatives from the DJs booking us, the homeboy bands, nobody. We were well respected by then already because they knew that we weren't a joke. So we didn't suffer that gender thing, even though they thought it was wild that we were doing it. We were now a part of that new rock scene that was growing every month, every year. And I must say, by this time, we had a good repertoire of songs too, which did help. We could play gigs and play a lot of different music.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up because Mary Joan Schmidt, who was the author of the press that we read from, she said you had a 55 song repertoire at that point. And I really want to underscore that you were good because you practiced the hell out of your songs. I mean, she mentions 5 days a week, and you're still teens, and you're still in high school and school or college, Nan at this point. And you're also, as you said, you're girls in a society that was, to use your expression, a little still buttoned up and pigeonholed, as
Oh,
you know.
yeah,
And
completely.
this included even Mary Lou Ball and Diane Baker leaving the band. Their parents, or at least the Ball's mom, said, nope, this is not for you. So I want to continue also about these lineup changes and where they were coming from and how they happened, because this is an extraordinary year for the pleasure seekers, because by the time it ends, you will have almost an entirely, well, I guess not entirely new, but a new lineup and a new manager, and you're raring to go. So let's just remind that right now in 1966, you had you, obviously, Susie, and you had Pris Wenzel on keys. You had nanosecond Sherry Hammerly on rhythm guitar. Sherry is out, and Eileen Binglingmeyer is in, or as you would call her, Lady Godiva.
Yeah.
And so the lineup again, you, Susie, Nan, Pris, and Eileen. But soon thereafter, and if you told us this, I want you to remind us. Soon thereafter, Pris leaves the band. So, what happened?
Well, Sherry leaving was on us, definitely. We started to feel that we needed a stronger musician. Sherry was a great gal, but she was filling a slot during this mishmash time where, a couple people left. So we were having a good sense that we needed strong musicians' vocals and had to make that happen in order to grow as a band and escalate our reputation and momentum. With Pris, I must say that's a hard one because my memory is dim of it. I don't think it was Pris leaving, but not positive. I do know there was a difference between the musicianship of Diane and Pris. Okay, so we must have had some feelings about it. She lasted for a few months there, but I know that that led us to look around for a better option. But it did happen, and I don't know who decided to leave, Pris, or whether we said, oh, you're done, because of what happened next.
Well, and we are going to talk about what happens next, but I do want to set the stage that and remind people of what you have said, Patty, and it's just because of society, you didn't have a large pool to pick from of female musicians. So you had to scramble a lot. And so whether Pris left or you kicked her out or it was a combo of both, I want to talk about what the process was of figuring out who would come in. And that, of course, is going to lead to Your sister, Arlene, the bombshell, aka Foxy Lady, is going to join. And we did talk about this a lot, but for listeners who may not have heard season two, tell us a little bit about the lead up to bringing Arlene in. First of all, did you audition other people? Were you at a complete loss?
You know, what I'm remembering is that my dad and I were very close. We would talk about music and all that. And I'm guessing I must have spoke to dad about a keys player. You know, probably let him know, well, I don't know, we might need to change again. And his line was always, no one is irreplaceable. That was what I lived with my whole life. He said that even when Susie and I parted and Susie went to England. You know, he would always say, no one's, you know, get back on the horse, get somebody. And first of all, Eileen was an easy pick. She was in choir. She had some good personality. She was real excited to come in, learning guitar. Her dad made an amp for her. That part happened real quick. Okay. We put her in, and nanosecond Sherry was out. And dad knew the keys was a tougher situation. It was a main instrument. You know, we had to have somebody good. One day during our talks, he just blurted out, you know, as he could with all his kids, you should have Arlene in on keys. And I was like, I got the idea that he was thinking about it privately and just holding his tongue. I was a bit in shock, as were the band girls. She was a bit older, had three kids, married. At first, it made me laugh. I was like, huh? Dad, what are you thinking? It was like so out of the blue. So, yeah, it was a shock.
Well, I think part of the reason why you said, huh? And again, we spoke a lot about this, and we are going to be replaying the conversation we had with your sister Arlene about joining the band. So that will be coming up for the listeners. But she was older. She was married. She had kids. So I
Yes.
think part of the huh was she was of a slightly different generation. So tell us more about this, of her joining.
Was the Elvis generation, you know. I mean, that was her people, Bobby Darin, Elvis, all those people. So it was quite a shock. And I remember during when we interviewed Arlene, I remember that I was shocked to hear some of the stories about her and dad. And the discussions they had that I knew nothing about dancing versus music and blah, blah, blah. Again, he put his foot down and he wanted her in the band. He wanted to see all of us in there.
Well, let's not give too much away about that story because we want people to hear the conversation with Arlene because it was, I mean, that was the first time I spoke with her, but she had such a poignancy in her voice about the story, which
Yes.
I do think also really adds to what was going on in society, what she was dealing with, how your father was the antithesis of treating women a certain way. He wanted all of his kids to get out there. So I just think it's fantastic. And we again we will play that episode for the listeners. But did her so you had to hip her up in her looks. We know that. And as I mentioned, there was an age difference. And she's married with kids. So how did the maturity issues come in, her age difference factor in? Were there issues with the kids? Tell us about this.
It was quite a deal. You know, I will say Arlene, though she was a mom, she was young at heart, and she married very young to her high school sweetheart, Leo. So that's a whole story in itself. You know, they had three quick kids, and she sort of peeled herself like an onion once she came into the band, discovering all she had missed in marrying young, and their marriage ended up being like brother and sister. You know, that's the sad part. But the band opened up a whole new Arlene to herself. Happy times and sad times. And it brought drama later. We got along great with her. There were no issues at all. My biggest issue was that she dressed and did hair more in the vein of the Elvis generation, you know, than the new rock. So we really had to hip her up. We just did it real gently, but we had to change her clothing. She was in mom clothing, you know, of the young mom, but still mom clothing. We had to get her styling, you know, change her hair. She had this long braid and a poof blonde on top of her head. We made her take it down and wear it down long and sexy. She didn't fight at all. She became a team player. She embraced it. I think it was fun for her, but she did lack confidence. So she just sort of went along with it. You know, she was going to do it. Okay, I'm going to give it a try. And that was that. We, full force ahead.
I love it. Well, some of the pictures I've posted for our podcast include
Yeah.
the long braid, but we will definitely look at those again. And your hipping her up, so to speak, absolutely worked. I mean, she became the, as you would say, the Pamela Sue Anderson of that
Oh.
day. I mean, guys just loved her. But before we get to that, the first time she joined the band, I love this story so much. You mentioned her husband, Leo, who is Leo
Yes.
Fenn. And I want to bring him into the picture now because, and we were talking about this at the beginning of the episode, you start to not only get booked everywhere, you start to get booked outside of the state. And at that point, you did need more than some kind of chaperone. And I believe you told me it was your father who said, "I think the band now needs a manager." Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, Dad, you know what? You might as well put in front of Dad the name Svengali, because he was like producing this whole thing himself behind the scenes. He was so there and present at every turn, every problem, supportive. He was amazing. And he did think we needed somebody managing because we were starting to travel out of town and everything. And of course, he got concerned. And Leo was working in the car factories again.
Another
So
killer.
he pulled him out of there and said, "You should manage the girls." I mean, they're good for Dad. He got us a manager. And Leo came right in.
And he didn't have any management experience.
Nothing, nothing,
But he did
nothing.
end up being very good at it.
Oh, he worked for Alice Cooper later in booking and stuff. He was a smart guy. And a sweetheart, really a sweetheart guy. So he fit right in. He was fine. He was going to take care of us. Dad wanted us to be protected in a way.
I love that. We'll start calling him Papa Svengali. It's so great. He is so, I love your dad. So Leo comes in, Arlene is now in, and we have talked about this story before, but it just sets the stage so perfectly with Arlene. Please tell us the story about your first gig at the frat house.
Oh God, it was a shit show. Arlene was scared to death. We were doing a college show and they put us on the roof of the frat house, right? And when there we were ready to start, Arlene knew her stuff. She suddenly freaks out. She runs inside and she didn't want to do it. Leo had to chase her down and say, "Get your ass back there and get on keys." And she did, and the gig went well, but it was important for her to see that she could do it. But man, she was scared shitless.
Well, she did it and she overcame her fears and it all, she's just wonderful. I just have such a soft spot for your sister. So, in addition to Arlene joining and Leo now becoming your manager, and remember they're married. So, you told me about a fascinating couple, but most especially a neighbor of theirs named Jim Hawk. So, please tell us a little bit who Jim Hawk was and how he came to contribute to the live performances of the Pleasure Seekers. And this is a reminder to the listeners that this is 1966 for the most part in the suburbs of Detroit. We're talking Grosse Pointe. So, this is, but also it's another groundbreaking moment in Grosse Pointe for rock and roll. So, tell us who Jim Hawk is.
Arlene and Leo had two best friends, another married couple. They had kids the same age. They did everything together. And oddly, as they went through their marriages, Lynn had the same situation with her husband. They were more like brother and sister and married young. So Arlene and Lynn were very close. Well, Jim and Lynn came to all the gigs. And they were so excited by this music venture that we were doing. And he was real handy with gadgets. And he decided, "Well, you need a light show behind you." And I don't know, frankly, about other cities, whether anybody else was doing that. But man, as far as I was concerned, he was the earliest, to my knowledge, to travel to make this light show for us and have us travel with it, which was not being done yet. Nobody was doing that. It was amazing, and the audience loved it. And then he would be at the gigs and run the light show behind us, and it was a psychedelic light show, right? And
Fantastic.
then he added slides of us later. So it just kept evolving. And then, actually, later years, it caught the attention of my friend Sherry McCormick and Gail Parento, who was the wife of Mark Parento, famous Detroit DJ. And they made a light show after Jim stopped and whatever. And they did the Grandy Ballroom and the Easttown Ballroom, and they escalated it even bigger. So it was the start of something, the inception point. And that was Jim Hock.
That's incredible. What a fantastic story. So, to clarify, he actually went on the road with you to do these shows.
Yeah, he went to gigs. Yeah.
So, you were obviously bringing in some kind of money to be able to afford all of this if you're being booked there, but traveling is expensive.
Yeah, I don't know how they did it. Maybe they just went to closer ones like in Michigan. I don't remember that part again in the Rock Ether, but he did come to a lot of them and he ran the show. I mean, we had nobody else doing that light show, so he did it.
That's
It was
wonderful.
amazing. And they loved being a part of it.
Well, and you brought up Sherry McCormick, and you and I on season one of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, when we were talking all things Fanny, she is thanked on the liner notes of the back of the Rock and Roll Survivors album. And that was one of your contributions. And I just love this idea of groundbreaking women in rock and roll, whether it's in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, or somewhere in between, as our podcast likes to say. So that's great. And Jim Hock, wow, that's legendary.
He was real early. It was amazing.
It's amazing. So you're gaining momentum now. You have a light show going on. You're playing all over the region. You're going outside the state, all over. This includes the college circuit. The buzz is out about the band. And then we get to another turning point with the band.
Oh, God.
We had spoken about how Mary Lou and Ann Ball's parents, most especially the mother, they were adamant that their daughters quit the band. Mary Lou was fine with quitting, but defiant Nan absolutely bucked. And she, I don't know, you remind me, I might have said, okay, yeah, to them, gave them lip service, but she bought her own set of drums with her own money. She hid them in her dorm room at the University of Michigan. She was still able to gig with you. And since her parents really never went to see you guys, you were able to have her continue. So I want you to now take it over and tell us what happened next.
This was an incredibly difficult chapter, this particular transition point. A drummer's important. She was like so into it. And it's a hard chapter for us and for Nan. Her parents did a surprise visit and caught her loading drums, and the gig was up instantly. Nan's mom was furious at being deceived. They loaded up the drums, took them home, sold them, and she was done and dusted. That was it. It was definitely a shocker incident that affected us deeply when it happened. The incident happened, and there we were yet again having to get back on that horse. And now we were going to have to look for a new drummer. Even with Dad's resilience of get back on that horse and find someone, but this loss of Nan was more of a shocker than losing Mary Lou or Diane or Pris or Sherry. This one was a shocker. She was one of the basics, okay? And an important one. She had personality and was popular, okay? So, yeah.
Well, let me say one thing here, because and we are going to post it. The last photo shoot with all of you and the Pleasure Seekers is with Nan was in October 1966 at the Cobo Arena with the Dave Prince Show. So before we get to hearing about Nan's response to all of this, because I do want her to have this platform through you, tell us about how that car shoot came about and all of that. It was a monkey's car, correct?
The monkey mobile. Yeah, it was a big, oh, it was in the press all over the place. They had it at Autorama. These were extravaganzas, these auto shows. It was Detroit, for God's sakes. And that photo is a classic. It had all five pleasure seekers playing for Dave Prince at Cobo, and they had that car on display. And of course, they piled us into the car and took a picture of us. It was Nan's last photo with us before the incident cutting off her musical dreams. You can see the joy in her face in the photo. She was always so invested in the love of playing drums, music, singing, the gigs. The entire atmosphere of being in the band moved her heart and soul the entire time she was in Pleasure Seekers. She was truly dedicated.
When I see that picture now, it brings tears to my eyes, knowing that that was pretty much the end for her. And we did talk a little bit about this, but I do want to hear more about Nan's response to her parents busting her as she's loading her drums in. I want to hear about this because, unlike her sister Mary Lou, who was fine with it that she had to leave, Nan was not. And Nan, as you have told me, really never got over it. So I would like you to talk about this.
You know, Nan and I were friends for decades. We never lost our friendship. We were close right through till the end. It was a huge impact and something she never recovered from, but she tried to. She was forced to let go of her passion and choose the career her parents felt she should follow. It crushed her for years. She married, she did a psychology career. She always felt the loss as we talked about it through the years. It wasn't a life she had wanted by any means. I did harbor anger at her parents that kill any parents that kill a child's spirit. I felt it was so wrong to do that to a child and kill their dreams instead of letting them find their own path. You know, that's, I didn't understand it. And I was blessed that my parents never would have done that in any universe. She had a life, she married, had a kid, a career, and yet the pain of her lost dreams lived deep inside her, as we would talk about. She would admit it to me. And it saddens me that she was not allowed to experience a life well lived, as anyone has a right. We all deserve that. I hold so much respect for all the fight she gave to hold her musical dreams tight in her heart and soul. The whole thing was so sad to me. I hated it. And, shall I go on? Oh my
Yes,
God.
please go on.
Oh my God. I will say it brings tears to my eyes even now. Nan died at a very young age in an unexpected freeway accident on a rainy night in Detroit, crushed between two cars. It was violent and quick. It was terribly ironic to me how she passed during a violent storm that oddly mirrored the storm she lived with inside her heart and soul that she was never able to resolve while she lived within someone else's expectation of what her life should be. She lived within an inner storm and died in a storm. A great gal, a huge loss.